Today is Tuesday, September 24th, and you're listening to The Job. This is The Job, a talk show about art, design, music, business, the web, and Portland. I'm your host, Ray Briglib. Our guest on this episode, number 30, is Craig Kelly, president of Venerable Properties. But first, let's talk to Needmore Studio Director Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
Welcome back to Portland.
Nice to be here.
What were you doing over the weekend? Anything interesting?
Well, Ray, I spent the weekend in San Francisco with my fella.
Mm-hmm.
That would be you.
Yeah, no, I know.
So it has been a while since we've gotten out of town. I think the having of the 11-month-old child has sort of put a damper on the traveling that we probably once did. So we had 48 hours in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a need more trip. We were down to do some touring and learning about a new client setup and all of that. And that part was extremely interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there was the part where we were hanging out in San Francisco without kids.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing I was really struck by was just the amazing food and drink scene down there. I think coming from Portland, I hear all the time about how Portland has such great food, which we do, and how, you know, cheap the food is. And after spending some time in San Francisco and having just killer food, mm-hmm. and drink, all quite reasonable and fresh and delicious, I'm pretty sure people are comparing Portland to like New York prices.
Like, what's messed up is that like rent, housing, that stuff is like seems 2 to 3 times as much in the city.
Oh God, yeah. The cost of living there sounds outrageous.
The prices of like going out to a good meal seem roughly equivalent.
Yeah,
and I know we were only there for 48 hours, but you know,
but
we got around.
I think I went there with this sort of attitude of like, I'm coming from Portland. We've got all the good food. I didn't expect, honestly, to be as blown away as I was by the food scene down there. I was just.
Yeah.
I mean, the first night we were staying in the Tenderloin at the Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
and we went for a walk and basically just happened upon a Thai place that had this great vibe happening and full, but not too full. I think we might have gotten like the last seat there, and the meal we proceeded to have was like blew my mind, and it was just sort of somewhere we passed. It wasn't like a recommendation, and it just turned out to be amazing.
We randomly stumbled across what everyone then told us was the best Thai in town, and
yeah.
Like, how did we even get a table there? It was like totally. Well, A, we were willing to sit right in front of the door, which I didn't really care about.
Yeah. But it was one of those small, bustling places where even when the door would open and close, you never got cold because there's just this like
right. Nothing. Well, there were so many people huddled around the door that not much air really made it in. But you could tell that it was, like you said, when we were going by there, it clearly had you could tell if you're a foodie by looking at it that it was going to be good. It had the right vibe. It had the right combination of, you know.
Inside, and every single person sitting at a table was happy.
Right.
Like, just was super stoked to be there, and you could tell. So that, their papaya salad with raw crab, it was spicy, it was bright, it was tangy, it was delicious. It was just, I've dreamed about that ever since.
Yeah, that was
so
remarkable.
That was a great introduction. And then Saturday morning, we stopped by Linnea Cafe.
Right. Andrew Barnett's new place. That was,
It's a waffle and coffee spot. And the waffles are from the fella that has Mission Cafe, whose name is escaping me right now. I'm so sorry.
I will put it in the show notes.
Waffles were like so good.
Yeah.
We had like a pastrami thing waffle, and they also have salads in the afternoon, which we didn't get to try, but apparently those are pretty amazing too. And then we also got to try Mission Chinese, which I don't know. I haven't really found like a favorite Chinese place in Portland. So that was really fun to have someone that was just
Chinese
making.
Chinese is really good too.
And you know, the other thing that I feel like we're still sort of missing in Portland is Mexican. Just like the right.
Yeah.
There's great Tex-Mex, but just like a straight out, I guess Chico is pretty good, but that's still not like the, you know.
That's not real Mexican. It's more like new American.
It's like coastal new, yeah. There's something different happening there.
And, you know, Mi Mero Mole is pretty darn good.
So let's get back to all the amazing food in San Francisco. Like, we're only to Saturday morning.
Yeah.
No, Saturday afternoon.
Right.
Then we stopped by The Mill, mm-hmm. Which is a collaboration between Four Barrel Coffee and Josie Baker.
Right.
Holy cow.
Yeah, that was
another
good.
Like, I think we went there 3 times in the 48 hours we were there.
Well, their specialty is like toast.
Yeah.
Which you'd think is silly, but like it's like toast. Yeah, it's like these giant pieces of this great bread that they make, and then like just really nice toppings, and you just get yourself a fork and knife and eat this giant piece of toast for breakfast. And then
and
we
the,
went there
and
for
the coffee.
Yeah, and
it's
the
like
coffee. And we went there for dinner too.
This incredible coffee. And yeah, at dinner they had was it a pop-up shop?
Yeah.
And it was
Cronenburger. Yeah.
So the burgers were fantastic.
Burgers
and what
were great,
excited me was that they were like rare to medium
they were
rare.
Darn
they
rare.
Were they were served like
they were served how you would order them.
They totally were, yeah. So you know, that was great. We got to see old friends. We you know, I'm still riding pretty high off of that experience. And the scene in San Francisco is just really amazing. I hope we have reason to head there more often because I loved it.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I mean, I lived in that area when I was a kid, so there's just something about the landscape that makes me really
just being
nostalgic
California.
And happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I'm going to move on now.
Alrighty.
We need some sort of signal for when you're done talking about your topic. Can you give me a signal?
I think you wrapped it.
Wrap. Okay,
you know,
we'll do the wrap.
I'm your guest, right? I'm here at your pleasure, so you let me know when
I think of us as co-introducers, like we're right. You know,
I
the
think
envelope,
of myself
please.
As like the chubby guy on the couch. You know what I'm talking about, though?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I think you're referring to Andy Richter, but I'm not sure.
Sorry, Andy.
No. Or Ed McMahon.
Kind of both, yeah. I'm sort of embodied.
Ed McRichter.
That's my role, yeah. I'm McRichter.
Yeah, so if you've seen, I'm going to introduce our guest now. If you've seen an amazing historic building in Portland, chances are that Craig Kelly has had something to do with it. Since 1994, almost 20 years, Craig has worked with to restore beautiful buildings like our very own, the one that we're in, White Stag, famous White Stag building. He dropped by the studio yesterday to talk to me about how he got there, what's next for Venerable, and why it matters. Without further ado, let's talk to Craig. Craig.
Hey, Ray. How are you?
I'm good. Are you from Portland?
I was born and raised here in Portland.
In the city or?
Mid-county, southeast Portland. I graduated from David Douglas.
Okay. Did you like travel a lot, do an on-the-road thing, or did you stay here?
I stayed here, but I traveled a little bit when I was in college, and I've traveled extensively since I've, you know, become a grown-up.
Yeah. Cool. So did you, like, did you go to school for the kind of thing you do, or?
No. My family always liked real estate per se.
Okay.
We had a few little rental houses here and there, and as I grew up, my dad would fix them up and we'd sell them for a couple of bucks and, you know, what have you. And I was studying economics at Portland State, and my dad had a Berry Farm in Gresham, and he decided he was going to be this big-time developer the Persimmon Golf Course in Gresham was being built, because we owned the Berry Farm across the street. And so I was taking a real estate appraisal classes and things like that. And subsequently, the early 80s came and the market went down the toilet. And my dad said, you know, I'm done, and got out and decided to work for somebody else, you know, in the... He actually worked for Sears and Caspars. He was a millwright, and I was on my own. So a real estate professor took me aside and said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, gee, I don't know. And maybe I'll be an appraiser or something. And he told me, no, you've got too much ambition and drive. You should go make the market, not report the market.
Okay. Interesting. How has Portland's real estate market changed since then, since it was down the toilet in the 80s? Is it?
Well, it's night and day.
Has it like slowly come back, or did you feel like there was a moment where you realized it was turning around?
Well, it's kind of ebbed and flowed. I mean, you know, the whole cost of housing it's still mind-numbing to me, the appreciation of housing and the cost.
Mm-hmm.
Has changed. You know, when I first got in the business, I was selling apartment buildings. That's how I got involved in older properties, and how my business partner Art and I met in Northwest. And, you know, we were bringing in these guys from the San Francisco Bay Area who were buying up a bunch of apartment buildings, and seeing how that, gee, for $25,000 a door, there are over 100 in San Francisco at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they started doing that condo conversions and things of this nature. And you know, that's just one aspect. And I remember when the Pearl District was just kind of getting started in Chowpella, they were trying to get $200 a foot for their condos. And I thought, oh, my God, it'll never happen. And, you know, of course, you know, what do I know, right?
Yeah, it worked.
But the market's very good today, and it's better. The urbanization of the city is for real. It's the real thing. I mean, you have a lot of in-migration, both young and old, and the demand is there. I mean, you see all these building permits for urban projects. You've got as bad or worse of a commute coming into the city at 5 o'clock than leaving, you know, like the old days, mm-hmm. the suburbs, because you got all these guys at Nike, Intel, et cetera, who want to live here
mm-hmm.
in the city. And you know, I mean, you look at all these great restaurants and retail opportunities we have in Northwest 23rds of the world that weren't there 15, 20 years ago. They were just thought of.
Yeah. Yeah. At Venerable, you're kind of known for working with historic properties.
Yes.
In a city that's busy growing and filling in all these spaces, why does it matter? Sorry about that. For those who are just listening, our light is okay.
Right, it's my personality.
Sorry.
Portland is blessed that we have a very large historic fabric for a small city. Big town, small city, you know, we have a disproportionate amount. So we have a very large historic district here in Skidmore, Old Town, as an instance, and, you know, very good historic per se for Portland standard historic housing stock, like Irvington, Ladd's Addition,
mm-hmm.
Northwest Portland, et cetera. So, you know, my business partner, Art, he started Venerable and I joined him soon thereafter. And so we just went after that narrow niche.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think either one of us thought we would be as large and successful as we've become.
Mm-hmm.
We've been very fortunate and blessed to be in the right place at the right time. And we're very proud of the work that we've done and are continuing to do.
Mm-hmm. We are blessed to be in, we're in the White Stag building here.
And we're happy to have you.
Yeah. Well, tell me what the story is behind this building. I mean, what was it like when you found it? Like, how did you put this together?
Well, this building was owned by the NATO family. Okay. For decades before we acquired it, 7-8 years ago from them. It was kind of benign neglect. They and probably the previous owners before them, and that's the case of in a lot of these historic buildings, they just don't, people don't do anything to them, mm-hmm. you know, and or they don't know how to do it, or the cost is so prohibitive to renovate them and take them to this different level. So when we came into this building, and this particular building that your office is in called the Bickle building, because mm-hmm. White Stag is three historic buildings that have been combined into one. Mm-hmm. An unbelievable amount of storage. The NATO family had owned Made in Oregon, as well as a company called Norcrest China. And it was stacked to the gills with boxes and boxes of kitschy little knick-knack kind of stuff that you find on your grandmother's end tables and stuff. And they took, I mean, I couldn't tell you, I have it somewhere, but I mean, countless 40-yard dumpsters of stuff out of here. So much so that the floors on this floor and the third floor below us actually raised above the beams, because there had been so many years of stuff stacked on the beams, and the beams had kind of done this slight little concave mm-hmm. that when stuff was lifted off the floor, you could kind of bounce on the floor like a quarter inch or something. It was kind of freaky.
Yeah.
We've subsequently fixed that.
Yeah, I'm sure. Take your word for that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, how do you put, like, the interior of this building has mm-hmm. a lot. So, and a little bit of personal story. When we were looking for a place downtown, we looked at a lot of places, and a lot of them probably had just as much history as this building, but were completely forgettable on the inside. It was just like a white corridor, and like you could barely find any exposed brick or anyone mm-hmm. bothering to make a window that you could even open, or, you know, there was nothing remarkable about them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this was, I think, the first place we looked at, and it made it impossible to look at anywhere else. It kind of ruined me, because I remembered, like, seeing the exposed brick and the way that you'd used materials and stuff. Mm. How do you pull that off?
Well, you know, we got a pretty good eye for this sort of thing, mm-hmm. and Art and I are pretty demanding. We know what we want. We, you know, part of the reason why we're called Venerable is we want to create venerable projects. We want projects that last beyond Craig and Art, mm-hmm. and that our grandchildren can be proud of, that, gee, Grandpa had something to do with that building. And we try to do things that are more timeless and not flavor of the month, mm-hmm. Right or wrong, but that's how we like to try and do things. And so we want to try and honor the history and its past of these buildings, but we want to modernize them enough to keep them going for the next 100 years. So we're big fans of natural daylighting, so we want to keep the daylighting exposed. Where we can expose brick, we'll expose the brick and the exposed timbers and things of this nature, which, you know, generally speaking, the market today wants it. But, you know, 5, 10, 20, 50 years from now, people will be putting in false ceilings again, or mm-hmm. shag carpet, or God knows what. Because that market kind of ebbs and flows. We're in the market now where people want more tangible, back to nature, more real. They want the higher ceilings. They want operable windows. And and so that's what we're trying to deliver.
And you did this in partnership with the University of Oregon, is that right?
Well, University of Oregon is strictly our tenant.
Okay.
We had worked with them on another property that didn't work out. And then I subsequently had contacted the NATO family, and they were pretty far down the road with another party to actually sell the property, and but we mm-hmm. convinced them to change horses at the kind of the last minute, and I think they would be very happy with what has transpired. You know, I think we've improved the building more than anyone expected, and as a result, we achieved pretty good rents, and I think helped instigate additional changes in this neighborhood. For instance, I don't know if Oriental College of Natural Medicine or Mercy Corps would be located across the street from us if we weren't here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, White Stag has, I mean, Old Town. I mean, there was, I'm from here. So, I mean, there was, for many years, you would never go to Old Town. I mean, you just right. didn't go there.
Right.
And you especially wouldn't let your grandma or mom go there or something. And now I don't think twice about yeah. it. And I think we're a small part of that
mm-hmm.
solution. And I'm proud of it. And you know why? You know, and we love the University of Oregon becoming a partner per se or tenant in the building because they bring a lot of energy and vitality to it. They've had thousands and thousands of events here that have brought countless people into the building and for that matter the neighborhood so people can say, wow, it is quote safe, and mm-hmm. I'm not going to get panhandled by every corner by okay. etc. So
just some it's a process. When you say you had some success, have you had some failures or some lessons learned along the way?
We've certainly have had lots of lessons. Every project has lots of lessons. Art and I have been very, very fortunate in that we really have had not any financial failures. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had one project in the Southeast that we ended up just barely making a little money on. We didn't lose money, so we view that as a success. But that was part of the function of the market. We had a partner in it that wasn't fully committed to what we wanted to do to the building and the timing, and it kind of stalled. And you could make some arguments that the location wasn't as good and as maybe we should have, but I think it would have worked out. But c'est la vie.
Yeah, I mean, can you talk about any projects that you're working on right now?
Yeah, our biggest project that's we're gonna work that's gonna be in the press very shortly is Washington High School, which is on the corner of Southeast 14th and Stark, and we'll be buying that property at the end of October of 2013 and starting construction immediately. And that's very similar to White Stag in that it's about 116,000 feet. White Stag's 137,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be one of these big events in that neighborhood that takes it to a different level.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really nice area that has, I don't think it's not been forgotten, but hasn't been given enough credit. And I think with Washington High School being redeveloped, people are going to, quote, discover it again, even though the building's been there for 90 years. And that's right. A beautiful old concrete building that's got a brick veneer, four stories tall, and we'll have about 20,000 feet of ground floor retail or service office and another 70,000 feet of office on the upper floors, with a 500 to 600 seat auditorium, which will run out for events. And we'll also have a 150 to 200 person rooftop deck for event space as well, along with as a building amenity for the tenants. And the beautiful part about that building is it's got the most incredible views of downtown Portland. You know, you most of the time you see you're in the downtown and you're looking at here, you're looking at the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, it's almost like a little kind of hill that it's on.
It's absolutely
right off Stark, right?
Yeah. It's on the corner of 14th Stark. And okay. I think people are surprised at that. You know, it's modest, but there's a real elevation change between downtown and that building. So it has a tremendous panoramic view.
Mm-hmm. And it's right by Nostrana. They'll love that.
Nostrana, and I think there's going to be a lot more retailers and foodies in that location, including our building.
When you look at a project like that, can you look ahead to like a day when you'll like be open for business, or is it just really hard to guess far ahead, you know?
Well, we absolutely on our first walkthrough can see it a lot of times.
Okay.
Or see some of it. I mean, that file of mine on that project starts in 2009, so it takes a long time.
Okay.
Some longer than others. This one particularly long to see it, and it has changed over time. I mean, we put a lot of effort in the first couple of years to turn that into housing, and the fact of the matter is it doesn't work financially, so we changed gears to figure out what would work financially, and this is the direction we're going now.
Okay.
But we're going to start construction, let's say November 1, and we'll be open for business and occupancy about 11 months later.
Okay. At some point, I think, referring to that project, you had said something about the Washington High, about the housing, that consideration about that was a preservation thing.
Well, the current zoning was housing focused. The neighborhood, who had a lot of interest and concern about that building for decades, wanted housing in the project. And we really tried hard to figure out how to make housing work.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with the building is it's an old high school. And if you want to, you know, Art and I are a little more preservationist versus adaptive reuse. I mean, there are some people who would gut it from the inside out and just maybe leave the exterior skin and go on its merry way. We wanted to preserve as much of the interior as well as the exterior. So the fact of the matter is the building's 116,000 feet, but you only have about 75,000 feet of rentable space because you got this big auditorium in the center, and you have 14 to 18 foot wide hallways with lockers. And I mean, it's an old school and we want to keep them. And so, you know, if you're only able to rent or sell, give or take half of a building, but you got to renovate a whole building, you got to be able to get enough rent and or revenue to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, housing didn't work.
Where do you feel like you picked up your skills at making deals?
I don't know, but...
Because I hear you're okay at it.
Yeah. You know... I guess I'm just a Irish guy that's got the gift of gab.
Okay.
You know, my mother and grandmother, I got a lot of their skills probably. You know, when I was a kid, I could, from Y Indian Guides, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, the whole Marianne, I was always one of the top popcorn salesmen or selling candy or whatever else I was doing. I just always was able to do it, and you know, I just some comes naturally.
Do you think that's something that helps when, you know, you were saying kind of the market might value historic properties differently? Do you think that do you think you have a special skill at explaining the value of a historic building to people?
Well, maybe. I mean, or I just reach some kind of connection with certain people. I mean, you know, there's always people who you don't connect with, but I think people who have an interest in leasing historic properties, for instance, probably have some of the similar interests and or concerns that I, who develop historic properties, have. And you know, for instance, a lot of people are very environmentally conscious in today's world, and I didn't want to save the trees per se, because and my way of saving the trees is to save these old buildings. But in essence, that's one thing of what we're doing. And I mean, I view saving these old historic buildings as one of the most green things anyone can do, because mm-hmm. you've got all this embodied energy already in these properties, and they've already been built, and frankly, they're as good or better than anybody can build today. So right. let's just take advantage of what we already got.
So things like this building is very energy efficient, but yeah. also LEED compliant. Do you think that's kind of part and parcel of the whole?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain firms that gain a lot of value on being in a LEED gold building like White Stag, and a lot of government agencies are required to be in that. The fact of the matter is, in today's modern building codes, I mean, it's almost a LEED building, LEED-like. Maybe LEED light already. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to do this cost benefit analysis of, is it worth spending another $1 million to get these 7 extra LEED points so you can get your glass plaque on the wall that says, yeah, you're LEED. And you know, you have to go through that process. And we did do that for Washington High School, and we've chosen it's not worth it. We can't figure out a way to, even though we're doing all these business building control systems that are very LEED-like, I just have to make a call. Mm-hmm. You know, I need these buildings to pencil financially.
Right, right.
So I can keep doing them
right.
in the future.
Yeah. Is I forgot my question. I had a question right there. I guess that happens. As someone who does the type of development work that you do and business that you do, are you also kind of fascinated with history? Do you know a lot of Portland history?
I do know a lot of Portland history. I'm actually quite a history buff, and my children really don't like going to traveling with me because they call me Mr. Sign Reader, because I read all the signs and they take photos of me throughout our travels of looking at signs. And no, but I actually know a lot about it, and I enjoy it a lot. And in fact, a lot of the things that I do read are more autobiographical on yeah. historical figures or events.
Have you, by random chance, been to like Minneapolis in the last 5 years?
I've never been to Minneapolis other than through the airport.
Okay. They are doing some remarkable historical work on the river there.
That's my understanding. As a matter of fact, we met one of the fellows who did one of those flour mills.
Yeah.
His name's not off the top of my head, but we talked to him in great detail when we were pursuing the Centennial Mill project, and we brought Tom, I can't think of his last name for the life of me, out to Portland. And subsequently, I think Jordan Schnitzer, who's now leading the charge on the Centennial Mill project, still has him under consulting contract. Mm. So yeah, they've done a lot of really cool adaptive reuse projects.
One of the more interesting stories, and I don't know how true this is or where I heard it, but was that a lot of the reasons that like those neighborhoods are like LAD and stuff, where those were people who ran the rail car lines through downtown at one point, and that they wanted to give people a destination to go across the river?
It wouldn't surprise me. You know, William Ladd and some of the founding fathers, for lack of a better term, of mm-hmm. Portland, they had all this foresight, but they weren't doing it for complete generosity either.
Right. Not pure altruism.
No. Yes. I think there was some other incentives there along the way.
Yeah. You know, that I just find that so interesting. When you see all the historical photos of Portland, they all have rail lines. That was so common in
streetcars.
Yeah, streetcars, and now yeah. it seems like that's kind of coming back.
Well, they're sure trying it, and you know, I remember in a meeting with Sam Adams long ago when he was running the transportation department, that you know he wanted to basically restore most of the streetcars to where the old streetcar lines were, Belmont, Sandy Boulevard, as examples. And I don't know if it will or won't, mm-hmm. but if the density continues, It might. And statistically, studies have shown, and this is, you know, Homer Williams and guys like that will attest to this, that higher density folks, and especially the upper socioeconomic, they prefer streetcars to buses, and the ridership, et cetera, will be higher, and that's what will help drive the density, whereas you're not going to get the same with more bus service.
Mm-hmm.
And so my recollection is that was one of the requirements to get that streetcar out into the Pearl District, and now we know what's there. And they punched it out to Waterfront, South Waterfront, and now we know what's there. And part of the reason why the city of Lake Oswego wanted to do a streetcar down that old line to change that whole area of the Foothills neighborhood along the river was to get that kind of urban density. But some of the folks in between and or in Lake Oswego kind of like it the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what will happen there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you like to read sort of nonfiction. Yeah. Is there something that you've read recently?
I don't read a whole lot. I'm, you know, I am from Southeast after all. But no, I'm reading this. I've read a couple of like Doris Kearns Goodwin on her latest, not latest, but the Team of Rivals,
mm-hmm.
that talks about Lincoln and his cabinet.
Did you finish that one?
I did. Okay. It was terrific. And then I'm just about finished with another book on how the Irish saved civilization, which is a short read, but it's interesting, you know, on talking about St. Augustine and Patrick and, you know, their roles in, you know, saving, quote, Western civilization from the barbarians as Rome fell.
Okay. Interesting. I've not heard of that. Do you have a current, favorite restaurant or anything like that in Portland?
No, I...
that is a tough question because Portland is exploding, especially with feasts just happening.
Well, I just that's just it, you know. I mean, I love some of the food carts out there, and I mm-hmm. like going to my local Vietnamese pho place, and, you know, my sweetheart and I, we like to come downtown here and there. We're just blessed to be in Portland where we have such a great variety, and, you know, well, gee, what do you feel like, and you just go there versus having to deal with, like, my family in Phoenix who has, you know, nothing but chain restaurants to deal with.
Yeah.
We prefer to go to more independent owned restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, we were just down in San Francisco this last weekend, and it used to be, I used to love to go there, just the density of places to go for food. And we went there just this past week, and I was like, you know, Portland's actually is catching up pretty quickly for, like, amazing restaurants you can walk to.
Absolutely.
Especially down here. I mean, it's just so nice. Just, where are we going to go for lunch today? You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, you get into your habits and, mm-hmm. you know, your 2 or 3 block radius, but if you're willing to drive 5 minutes, the world's your oyster,
mm-hmm.
and not just Dan and Louie's.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Craig.
Thanks, Ray. Appreciate you take it. Care.
Some Other Guy is a rhythm and blues song written by Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, and Richard Barrett. It was first released by Barrett as a single in 1962, with a backing band featuring an electric piano, an unusual sound in pop music at the time. Now, my first impression of this song, this version of the song, is I just saw your chat message. Is that it reminded me of Ray Charles.
Absolutely.
And yeah. My first thought is, well, Ray Charles had kind of a hit with a song that sounded like that in 59. What I Say. But then I was thinking, well, that probably wasn't really a hit in 59. That was probably a hit in the rhythm and blues charts, which, as we know, doesn't translate into a pop hit in the 50s.
Racist.
Yeah, exactly. That's another euphemistically saying racism. But, yeah, this version, this song, this very catchy. I really love the background vocals. You don't necessarily expect them because it has kind of an R&B feel. And then, like, you get that kind of soul backing vocal of the girls. And it starts out really mellow with the electric piano. And then it just kind of takes off. It really does remind me a lot of Ray Charles.
Except, like, the lyric or mm-hmm. the vocal delivery is so, like, mumbly and subdued and wonderful for yeah. that. Like, it's just like...
The thing I like is that he doesn't sound like a singer.
Right.
He's just kind of like, I think I could sing this one rather than give it to someone else.
He was just
else.
Sketching it out for whoever was actually right. going to take lead vocals.
Yeah. Yeah. He has a really weird sort of sounding voice. And the pacing and the phrasing of the song, I really like. How, like, mm-hmm. you expect he's coming back to the chorus, but then randomly, like, the backing vocals sing it. And then it's like he kind of continues the verse from there, and then they kind of alternate. But where I originally heard this song was, this probably most people, was the Beatles played it. It's well known as being the first synchronized video or film and and recording that exists of them. And you can easily, if you look for some other guy on YouTube, it's the Beatles version you'll probably find. And it's an excellent, it reminds me a lot of what they did with, like, Twist and Shout. Mm-hmm. Because if you listen to the Twist and Shout, not the original, but the one that everyone knows before that was the Isley Brothers. It has that sort of soul feel to it. And then the Beatles just turn it to, like, straight up, you know.
Garagey.
4/4 yeah. rock. Yeah. Just really loud, like really heavy. And the same with this. It's like there's no pretense of backing vocals. It's just Lennon and McCartney singing it, you know, full-throated. But yeah, this is an excellent song. I can see why it was so popular to cover around then, you know.
Definitely. Yeah, there seems to be so much fun to be had, especially with the, like, structure of it. Like, you can play around with it.
Yeah, yeah.
So much, and, like, just do what you want with it.
Yeah, and I think maybe the fact that it kind of structurally has what seems like rough edges to it makes it more accessible to a band who doesn't want to, like, mess with something that people have already heard or is a classic. Probably in, you know, the Merseyside area where people were playing this a lot, no one had ever heard this. You know, it didn't penetrate the radio in the UK, so it was probably fair game.
Right. I love that it was released in, what, 62?
Mm-hmm.
And the Beatles recording is from 63, but they were playing it, like, a full year before that.
Mm-hmm.
That means they were playing it, like, right after it was released.
As soon as it came out, yeah.
Yeah. Just like, that, we're going to learn this.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of those bands, they would just, like... I feel like they bought as many of those singles as as Americans, you know? They were just like, oh, this is great, we can play this.
Or more. I heard Elton John was interviewed on Fresh Air last night, or yesterday, okay. And I caught a bit of it while I was in the car, and he was talking about this, like, the late 50s, early 60s, like, buying record American music. And he's just like, the main reason the Brits were so obsessed with this is we just didn't have it anywhere. Like, it was as though a UFO had come and just dropped sound on us.
Yeah.
I was just like, that makes sense. All right. So, yeah, like, I imagine more popular in, you know, parts of London and
yeah,
Liverpool.
Yeah, and a lot of those, you know, that's I think what got me on this kick was kind of, I was listening to old Sun records, an old Sun records collection from like the late 50s kind of era. And there are so many bands that all that so many tracks in there that everyone covered. I mean, certainly Elvis basically redid half of the Sun catalog, but like, so did like all of those, you know, beat bands. The British Invasion were covering tons of Sun recordings. Certainly, I would guess most of those musicians made more from being covered by all the British Invasion bands than they did from their recordings, you know.
If their contract allowed.
It was pretty uncommon. But I would imagine that, like, you know, Carl Perkins, especially the Beatles, you know, that was like George Harrison's idol. I think he even went by Carl Harrison or something at some point.
Really?
When they used to have pseudonyms in the early days. But and then I was kind of like, well, what? I just started looking for all the songs that the Beatles used to cover, because a lot of those bands would, like, you'd hear Yardbirds or Stones or Animals, or, you know, all those bands would cover these same sets of songs.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, it's almost like you would see a set of like 10 British Invasion bands, and they might accidentally not just wear the same outfit, but play the same cover songs. Like, oh my gosh, you wore the Beatle boots too? What are the odds?
That is a unique black suit, sir.
Yeah. Oh.
The B-side of this was Tricky Dicky.
There, I was reading somewhere that someone had covered both sides. Was it? I know that some other guy, it said in there, like, among the bands that covered it were Led Zeppelin.
And it's, I was in, like, it, like, Jimmy Page would play parts of it during solos. I know, like, bootlegs where, like, you would just hear, like, the melody line.
Okay.
But I think they also actually covered it sometimes, like, during bridges of other songs.
Jimmy Page solos.
Yeah.
Kind of Neverland. It's like a lot of musicians do that, like sure, Jimi Hendrix. There's a name for that where you kind of throw in a bit of another song in your performance, like, so or whatever. You know, it was... Well, like, another one thing they said about this was that Lennon made a reference to this song at the beginning of Instant Karma. I mean, it's a pretty basic two chord, like, dun, dun. But you think about Instant Karma, it starts with, like, those two kind of notes. That was, I think, to the Beatles, that came from this song. But I think it became I don't know. I mean, it's two notes.
Right.
I mean, you know. But, yeah.
If they hadn't told us, no one would know.
Right. But, yeah, like Hendrix would always do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seemed like he had like the beginning of, wasn't it, Purple Haze? That pair of chords that start that were known in the Middle Ages, considered, you could basically get executed for playing them. Like, they were considered...
blowing my mind right now.
Considered a pair of notes in succession that would summon the devil.
Huh.
But Hendrix heard about this and he was like, I'm going to start my I will hit be
summoning
song
the devil at the beginning of every show.
So I don't know. I think that's probably cooler than Richard Barrett's.
That's great.
But you think about that. Those are some pretty discordant notes he starts Purple Haze with. But then again, he was a person who liked to play with discord
and fire.
And fire. That's right.
That became creepier now that with the cold. And fire.
Oh, you have a cold?
More just allergy. Rain started.
Yep.
Kicked everything up.
No, I have the same.
Yeah,
I just wake up and sneeze for a half hour.
Last Friday
was
the anniversary of Graham Parsons' death,
which
means like maybe yesterday was the anniversary of his body being stolen from the airport. Like perhaps the greatest...
Wait, what the hell? What?
You don't know the story of
Graham? I don't know this story. Tell me this story.
Oh, well, so Graham Parsons OD'd in like a hotel room in Joshua Tree.
Okay.
And his stepfather wanted to bring him back to Louisiana, where he's from, to bury him. And before his death, he had like kind of made a pact with like his tour manager and some friends, like, I want to be cremated and scattered at Cab Rock in Joshua Tree. So they were going to hold him to that, or hold themselves to that fact, and they stole his body from the airport. And, you know, like a stolen hearse or rented hearse or something. And, like, just took the coffin and dragged it out to Joshua Tree and set it on fire, like, badly. Uh-huh. Like, it's like a complete clusterfuck from start to finish.
Cremation requires a lot of heat, yeah.
Yeah, and...
You know, just gonna pour lighter fluid on it and...
But they ended up, like, getting... And, like, the cops who arrested them or, like, tried to arrest them were themselves drunk. Something, they were, like, off-duty. So, like, even the arrest was a mess. And wow. There's no laws for actually stealing a body. So they were just charged with stealing the coffin.
Okay.
Huh. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Like, the weirdest... Like, my favorite, like, weird rock star, like... Or, I guess he's not a rock star. Rock star death lore. Like... Just stole his body and took it out to the desert.
Wow.
But then he was ended, his stepfather took the body back to Louisiana eventually. Charred, sadly.
I'm not going to say anything about that. That's just too easy. Okay. Well, cool. interesting. That was... I'll put that in the notes here. Jimi Hendrix devil notes. Graham Parsons, comma.
Speaking of charred.
Fire. Some other guy. Okay. Cool. Do you know what song you're going to pick next week, or do we just wait? And
I don't.
You don't have to.
The song that I've been listening to most recently, it would be embarrassing for me to like choose. It's, okay. It's, so I'm going to have to give some thought to
okay.
this.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Well, we'll see you next week.
Bye.